Coming up, actress Rae Seahorn joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV show.
What really happens? Hi, I'm Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. My lovely co-host, Tamara Bird.
Hey, everybody.
Here we are. It's midsummer, hot summer nights.
And the AC in the studio is maybe not as cool as we would like it.
But it's good. It's like we're in a Tennessee Williams
exactly
play a little bit.
My dress might come off. I'm just saying.
I'm so excited to be talking to Rae Seahorn. She has, first of all, kudos. You thought I was going to say for Better Call Saul, but no, kudos for her reading of I Blame Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
And of course, Better Call Saul, which is an amazing show with Bob Odenkirk, who we need to get on the show. I've known Bob for ages. He's wonderful and talented.
We're calling him then next week.
But she's, we're sharing stories about, you know, being out there in the world doing auditioning and this, that, and the other.
And how crazy that business is.
I know, always. And I always like to tell I'm going to tell my favorite bad audition story.
Oh, fantastic. Can't wait.
My favorite bad audition story is when I was growing up and when I got into the Hartford Stage Company, youth theater, when I was 15, my life centered around one film, and that film was Fame. Like, I thought it was real. I was so upset.
I loved that movie so much.
Yeah, I wanted to go to New York to be in that high school that didn't exist. Like, it just... And so when I got into the Hartford Stage Comedy Youth Theater, all the other people that were my age, I mean, that was our Bible. We had the album. We'd listen.
I sing the body. Please.
Were you Coco? Who was your character? Who did you...
Well, I certainly wasn't the red-haired dude. That's for sure. He was screwed up. I think I was kind of a little... I think I hate to admit it. I think I was a little Barry Miller. I think I was a little of a class clown.
Yeah.
But I love the whole... I mean, the whole movie was amazing.
Absolutely.
And we were in the stage company, which was ethnically diverse. And so, like, we were like... We were Fame. I mean, we thought we were Fame.
Yeah.
And so cut to me carving out a little career for myself and getting into films. And I was in Cape Fear and everything. And the day arrives, and I'm going to be auditioning. I don't remember the name of the movie, but I was auditioning for Alan Parker, director of Fame, and another movie that later on became my secondary obsession, which was Shoot the Moon. If you get a chance to see it, Diane Keaton and Albert Finney. Yeah. It just touched me deeply. My parents were divorced. There was a lot of chaos. And boy, that movie really struck a chord for me. So I couldn't wait to meet Alan Parker to audition for this movie. The movie was, I can't remember the name of it, but Anthony Hopkins was the star of it. And it was about the guy who invented cornflakes up in the mountains.
Oh, yeah. With
Matthew Broderick.
Broderick.
It had some kooky title to it anyway.
Yeah.
So I go in and audition. And the casting director was Howard Fuhrer. That was his name. He's no longer with us, which is a shame because he was a big fan of mine and back in the day. But so Howard Fuhrer came in and brought me in for this role. And I was so excited. I couldn't wait. I had all my speech ready to talk to Alan Parker. And he just was like, why don't you start? You know, like, couldn't have cared less. And so I do... I'm sitting there and I do the performance and I think I'm killing it. You know, like, there was, you know, you're acting, but there's that little part of your brain where you're like, oh my God, I'm on fire. I'm already on the set sharing stories with Alan Parker. He probably is going to invite me to England. We're probably, you know, going to be best friends, you know. And I'm crying and I'm doing the part and all of a sudden he just gets up and just stares at me, and he goes, who sent you here? And he just got up and went to his phone and said, Howard, can you come in here right away? He goes, Howard, what is going on? She's not right at all. And they're like talking about me.
As if you're not there.
As if I am not there. Now, I was like mid-cry. I'm sitting there like crying, you know, and then you know when you're trying to stop yourself. I was like, got stuff coming out of me. I have no Kleenex. There's a coffee table there. I was like, maybe I could just quietly, like, I find a little Kleenex. I'm sort of like, you know, and I actually, this is how delusional you are as an actor. I actually was looked up at him and I go, I could do it again if you, you know, and he just looked at me like, why are you still here? Why are you in the room? And he literally like turned his back on me. And then said, Howard, get Franny on the phone, Frances McDormand. He goes, get Franny on the phone and blah, 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 you know. Talk. So he starts talking to Frances McDormand on the phone.
While you're still standing there sniffling and trying to stop the cheers.
I was like, at least going to try to say goodbye. I was like, no, Alan Parker hates my guy. He's not even going to turn around for me. And I went out the door and I was like being punched in the stomach. And Howard Feuer, bless his heart, He goes, oh, well, you know, he says, I want to tell you, there's a movie that I'm just about to do. It's called To Die For, and there's a part in it, and you're perfect for it. So, you know, chin up. Don't, you know, don't worry about it. So I walked out. But so screw you, Alan Parker. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
That is the moral of the story.
Alan Parker, you lost your biggest fan. No, I still think he's tremendous, and it's a very funny story. But I just tell that because, you know, we've all had these – you just got to laugh. You got these horror stories. But did I think I was perfect for that part? And apparently not. Apparently not. And who sent you here?
Who sent you here? Because you are wrong. Now, have you also had auditions where you
good auditions? No.
Never. Oh, come on. No, auditions where you thought you were terrible. And then,
no,
you know, or
I'm
made
delusional.
A mistake. Or
any actor, like, rarely thinks they're bad. That's sort of like,
oh my God, that's why I stopped. My approach to everything is I'm the worst at it, but I'm trying.
I mean, I've known that I was bad, you know, in a movie, you know, that you're
once like, you have the gig, you mean
that, you know, like I've known. Well, you have an awareness of like, that wasn't good and I want to do it again. In an audition, I mean, it's such an unrealistic thing.
Yes.
You're going in a room and people are sitting there staring at you. And, I've tried every angle in the universe in terms of auditioning. You know, do you go in and you write in part? Do you joke around and then, you know, become like a maniac? I don't know. There's every angle of it is kind of, you know, ridiculous. But 9 times out of 10, I would feel like that I was pretty good, except for there was a whole time where I kept going in to read for roles that were written for men, you know, and so you'd go in and you'd be like, okay, how do I play this? It's like, and they would, the casting person would say, well, you know, we wrote it for a man. It might be a woman's part. Well, we don't know, you know, so you'd come in and we're like, yeah, we're either going to go with a man or Ileana Douglas. what does that say about her? So,
that might be one of the chapters in your next book, either a man or Ileana Douglas.
Yes, one of the best. Well, I'm sure that Rae Seehorn doesn't have to worry about things like this.
Yeah, let's bring her in.
Of course, everybody knows Rae from the huge hit Better Call Saul, and but she was also on the sitcom Whitney with Whitney Cummings, as well as Franklin and Bash. Oh, that's a show my mom always used to watch. That's a good thing. My mom's like a TV-aholic. She knows every great show that was on. But she's also been in the independent film Riders and Floating, and she is a woman of many talents. She also began as a paint. You did painting and drawing and architecture. Here she is sliding in. Welcome to the sauna, Rae Seehorn.
So sexy in here.
It is.
But this is, you know, but this is what it's like on movies all the time. They turn the AC off.
Is it, Ileana? Tell me about being on a million movies. 'Cause I haven't been on them.
The Most, I'm trying to, I've never been on a cool, well, actually, except for Alive, which was 30.
Where you nearly got frostbite every day.
How many films have you been in so far?
Not a lot. Like shorts and really indies that didn't make it to air. And but you know, I'm working on that. But TV's also hot.
So here's a question. has everything you've been done digital, or is it any genuine film? Or is it all
I have
digital?
Shot on film, but only like once. I mean, from the get-go, especially when I was doing super low-budget indie films, you know, during college or with friends, and right when I got out of college, as soon as people could do anything about making it cheaper, they were going to. So that was the first push, I think, to go to video, as much as every single one of those film students would have liked to have shot on film. But yeah, it's interesting. When I talk to DPs now, both Arthur Albert, that began our season on Better Call Saul, our series, he did season one and two, and then Marsh Adams did this current season three. I've asked them about, like, do you miss film and stuff, and which I'm sure you've had those conversations with a lot of the directors.
I miss it.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
See, I don't remember from only doing, like, I mean, literally, I shot some stuff on Bolex, which is crazy, on a Bolex, but... They said they like their not being limited number of takes. They felt good about that. They felt good about not being hemmed in to try things. But they missed some of the purposefulness with the way you approached having limited stock and knowing you were burning money.
That's what I feel, the specialness of that a mag was 20 minutes.
Right.
And as an actor... You know, you had about three chances to do it. No, I'm serious. Wow. I'm serious. And so...
Especially if it was a long take, like some of the films that you've done.
Oh, my God.
Seriously, because, long takes.
Yeah. So there was a sense of excitement, I think, for everybody to try to do something, get it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, there'd be the thing like, where are we on the mag?
Right.
We had enough of like, okay, let's go for it. You know, and you'd be like, okay, you talk really fast, get it, and nail it, and all the technical things.
And it's beautiful. I mean, there's no getting around that. The product is beautiful.
But I just thought there was a that sense of purposefulness, as you said, and then there was a time of reflection, believe it or not, when they would change the mag and clean the gate and all
really?
That.
Like how long would that process actually be?
About 5 minutes. I mean,
that's long on a film set. That's, that's long.
Yeah. Take about 5 minutes, but to take the old mag, put the new mag on, make sure that it was ready. And again, what I'm always complaining about is just the limited time you have for an actor to get on the set. It's as if, like, I don't know when this happened, but I blinked, but it's like the crew has the set now for 90% of work, and the actors are like,
just to rehearse the scene.
You come in and you're like, they've told you, oh, your stand-in has done this, and I always want to stand in. No, Ileana, it's fine. Go stay.
I stay unless they make me leave.
Yeah, every time. Like, I want, because it doesn't feel like there's enough time to...
No, from everything from just the very practical things of, like, you're supposed to look like you hang out at this desk all the time, or you've been in this video store 400 times. Well, then you need to stand around it. You need to not look like you're not sure where the cash register is. You know, those kind of things. To running lines and getting comfortable with your scene partner. My show now allows more rehearsal than I've ever had on television, but still it's not a ton. It's not like it's theater or anything.
Yeah.
And then we, as a cast, I think probably because the entire cast came from stage performing, maybe that's part of it. We all get together off camera and rehearse ad nauseum.
I think that's a good idea.
Just because we miss it. Same thing. Everybody always misses it.
What about working with your props, which is another thing that kind of drives me crazy. I get on a move. Oh, don't touch. Please. I'm in my own kitchen. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Let alone if now I want you to use it in the scene. Use that blender in the scene. I've never seen this blender in my life.
I'll pour it for you. It's like, oh, okay. And I start to get like a rage that builds in me where I can't touch the orange juice and I can't until the camera's going.
Right.
You know? And I'm so nervous because I love working with props because they grab
me. Do you?
Yeah. Because I find that I want to be in my kitchen. I want to. They're like, what are you? And then, you know, I'll start opening. What are you, Ilya, what are you doing? Are you, do you need something? Or can I get you a latte? Like, no, I'm actually just trying to act.
I'm going to be present in my kitchen. Yeah. That's what I'm doing.
My job.
Yeah. Right? My first couple of years in theater, I shook so badly on stage from nerves that I remember one of the first professional plays I had that wasn't academic, I had to hold like an envelope, this important envelope in someone's hands, and it's rattling and you can see it, and then I wasn't allowed to touch props for like another year after that. It was so obvious. I thought I was going to throw up right before I went on.
How did you get over that?
I didn't. I still like, I have massive stage fright on camera and on stage. It goes away a couple minutes after the lights come up or the camera starts rolling. Right. But there's always that first, which is why auditioning is hard for me. I always feel like, can we just do two? Can we automatically do two runs at this? Because the first one, which I guess, you know, there's some people, they're gauging, are you great in the worst circumstances? Because that's how we'll know if we have a strong actor that that's going to make it. And I kind of don't agree with that, because we're all vulnerable. I mean,
yeah.
And you did theater too, right?
I did years and years. And stand up. I was saying
stand up sounds terrifying to me. Terrifying.
Oh, it was. Sorry,
horrible. I did some sketch, and that was terrifying.
About the minute I got a job, it was out. It's like, this is horrible. How do people do this?
Did you, with their props, did you do the whole like? What's it called? Prop endowment, where you like supply a sense memory and a story to it and all that.
Because that's how I was trained. At the neighborhood playhouse, we used to do something that was called an independent activity.
Okay.
And so, you know, you're cleaning a piece of jewelry that belonged to your mother, and you have to sell it because you have two babies and you can't pay the rent.
Yep.
So you create a story and then the meaningfulness. And I have to say, for me, like the sense memory didn't work, but that physicality of putting myself in a position where, okay, I'm going to have to clean this thing that belonged to my mom and I'm going to have to sell, would always work for me. And it would always bring me to an emotional point of where the scene needed to be. Now, granted, you know, those are the things you have to do kind of off stage before you're shooting. So I find that if you can sneak something like that into the scene, I bring in my own pictures, you know.
I had some of that in my training as well, and I always loved it. And I also loved the idea of having a secret on the set, which sometimes is a prop as well.
Yes.
That you can just decide that that pillow, you know, so-and-so made it for me, and I know it's ugly, but I'm going to keep it forever. And it just made, like, automatically the scene is sort of charged of like, he sat on the pillow. Okay, well, you know, that's right. You're not saying anything, but there's something percolating, and it makes scenes real.
I used to do that. There was a farce I did, which was called Ring Round the Moon. One of my favorite things, the farce back in school. And I used to believe in that too. And you know what one of my crazy secrets was?
What?
It's insane. I don't know how I thought of it, but it works every time. You have an egg. You put an egg in your clothing that you know can break.
Really?
And I cannot tell you how much it makes you laugh, because you're like, oh my God.
Do such strange things to your physicality too.
Yeah, because you're
that's
like...
That's funny.
Because if somebody gets too close to you, they're going to break the egg, or the egg's going to drop, or... I don't know. I can't tell you how many times I did it, and it would always work. And I never broke the egg. But like, I would do things like that that were, you know, that were like goofy. Because we were in school, and our teacher always encouraged us to fail. That was like his big thing. He wanted
us
to be. Yeah. He wanted, he used to make us, in fact, which is one of the, we would get in hysterics. He would make us do bad Shakespeare.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We'd have to do it as big.
I would have excelled at that class.
And because he had a theory that if you did it as bad as you thought it was actually pretty good.
Interesting.
Like, as, you know, how?
Yeah.
my Lord. And eventually you sort of kick into something that becomes kind of real.
I love that.
I know. We learned a lot of like great, you know.
I love that. I would have loved to have trained at the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh my God.
My training was all hodgepodge. Like anybody that would teach me a class, I'll take a class there. And this technique, this technique, which is some of that's been a positive thing for me. Just a tool bag that I pick out what I want to use. But Neighborhood Playhouse is always fascinating.
Oh my God. It was great. It was very beatnik. I felt like we were, even though it was the 80s, it was like their mentality was very, you know, we're doing like Waiting for Lefty, which is like the 1930s.
Dig it.
You know, workers.
Dig it. I remember in school wanting to do No Exit like for like a decade. I just wanted to like investigate each role.
I know. I was always doing things that were like wildly inappropriate, you know, because we were like too young.
Oh,
we
didn't
understand them, but they were certainly fun. So, okay, we always get to our very first question, my favorite question. Do you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
I do. I was, and I was trying to do the timeline the other day on this because someone else was asking me about this because I grew up mostly going to drive-in movie theaters were my first movies in Yuma, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And it was I thought at the time that all movies had Charles Grodin and Goldie Hawn in them and Chevy Chase. It was like like old times and foul play. There were always a lot of dogs. But then I realized no. I did go to a movie in a movie theater, and at that time I want to say Yuma had like one movie theater that just played one giant blockbuster film. Mm-hmm. And my mom drove me really far out of town to see this very indie film that was only playing one place, and that was Star Wars, the original Star Wars. Oh. And I was obsessed with the, there were princesses in it and spaceships and creatures talking and all of this stuff that I saw commercials for. But I can't remember how old I was, but I was not reading yet. Mm. And I remember the lights going down and that narration comes up, the scrolling narration. And I burst into tears.
You were missing something.
I completely thought it was false advertising. And I was screaming at my mom, "We're just going to read. We're just going to read." And then there was pictures. I was freaking out. And she's, because I couldn't read any of it. And that's what I thought I was going to just be a book scrolling for like 2.5 hours. I was like, they had pictures and commercials, you know, and then a ship came in.
Thank God.
I loved it, though.
That was a hard couple of minutes.
Dude, I thought I had some trouble with, I had a lot of first movie experiences involved, like trouble separating reality from fantasy.
I know, but
and false advertising and, like, you know, marketing being a sham.
Betrayal
were huge issues.
But that's what was so great about, you know, there was such an excitement when you're little to see a movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, although we have access to seeing many movies, it was, you know, it doesn't seem as special to, like, go see a movie. And especially, I think, the bond of the person who takes you to see the movie, too.
I thought it was cool that my mom would drive. I mean, we were in a sketchy town to try to find this film in a one art house movie theater.
I love that.
It was great.
Do you still go see movies with mom? Like, my favorite mom movie experience, we used to always go see movies together. But my mom and I always talk about when I took her to see Something About Mary.
Oh, really?
We always laugh.
That's
she
funny.
Loved that movie. And so when I go home, I force my mom. It's the only time she ever goes to the movies is when I come
My mom,
home.
Too. She's back in Virginia. And, like, it's not a normal activity for her friends, or her husband. It's strange. I'm not
it
sure
used to
why.
I don't know. I guess you grow up and you're like, movies are for kids. But whenever I go home and we go to the movies, we always have, like, a great, you know, we have a great time. But when I was growing up, my mom, we would always go to the indie movies or anything with Alan Bates. My mom was.
Oh, really?
Yes. My mom was obsessed with Alan Bates. So.
Oh, that's funny.
So
I wanted to be the household that, like, grew up going to, you know, Cassavetes films, but we didn't. The Star Wars was the one and only. Yeah, everything else was Charles Grodin.
Has it been, like, in my book? Have you ever met Charles Grodin?
No, I think I wouldn't know what to do. I used to love to watch him when he would come on David Letterman. And he was so dry that about half the audience could not figure out if it was a joke or not.
Yeah.
But my dad had a remarkably similar line delivery and wit about him. And so I used to just crack up. And I thought it felt like I was part of some secret club if I got Charles Grodin. Uh-huh. I was obsessed. If I met him, I don't even know what I'd be able to do. I don't know what I would do, I mean. Have you met him? Tell me he's nice.
He's
dry, right?
I had my only dealings with Charles Grodner when I worked for a film publicist named Peggy Siegel.
Okay.
And I used to call him on the phone because we were working on Midnight Run. And so any excuse, you know, to call sure. him. But I had to be, I was working for someone, so I couldn't be like, hey, by the way.
That's funny. My dad was an exact combination of Alan Alda, Charles Grodner, and Bob Newhart. So I was always obsessed with all three of them. Obsessed.
Wow, that seems like a great dad. What did your dad do?
He was a counterintelligence agent for NIS.
What?
What?
Do people? Does everyone have the same reaction? I don't know why.
They do, because it seems like a made up job, and I'm like, but you realize that someone has to have that job. Someone does, and
I know,
and
but
when
not
you're doing
you know.
When you're doing counterintelligence, naval intelligence, naval investigative service.
Right.
The work he was, you're off. Like, we moved to Virginia to catch the Walker spy family because he was involved in that, and so those are people that are aware that he's not undercover. It's not like people are like, how did you know he even had that job? Was he in a costume every morning? And I was like, no, he wasn't.
Did he have a cape?
Right. No.
That's what they really want to know.
Exactly. And he wasn't. Apparently, he did do severe undercover work and stuff like that.
Love it.
But before I got into the picture, by the time I was there, it was more about, you're investigating like moles and spies within amongst your own. So I knew I knew what his job was. I wish I hit. He died when I was 18, and at that point had been doing it 33 years. And I wish I had gotten my head out of my ass earlier in life to ask him questions that now. But like at that time, I was just like, he was, he would hand me Newsweek about the Walker spy film, and he's like, that's your dad right there in that paragraph. And I was like, whatever. I did not give a shit.
Oh,
I felt so bad. I think I was...
Yeah.
I was probably 12 then. It was just
so
I was an idiot.
Did it hit you later on? I mean, I always feel like being an actor is being sort of a spy or being in counterintelligence.
It is. I mean, you're definitely, hiding in plain sight.
But plus, like, you have to make instant assessments of people, whether you're working with them and auditioning with them. And
yeah, I think so. I think it's part of it. I watched my dad shift his personality, and I watched my mom... my mom's very independent and smart and sassy and beautiful, and I was very keenly aware from a young age that she was putting on a persona to be his wife, especially at a government thing or on base. There's just ways that wives are supposed to behave that I remember thinking, that suit looks itchy on her.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? She carried it with grace, but...
What era is this? Is this
that
the
would
70s?
Have been 70s and early 80s. They got divorced. No love loss going on in that divorce. No. But she then kind of like went on to figure out who she was. That was not who she was.
What was your experience? Because at a certain point you're living in Japan.
That was also about spy stuff. That was. It was some, and I need to research more of it because I found a scroll that he was given, weirdly enough, recently from Japan. We were in Atsugi, and it had to do, I was so young. I mean, we went there pretty much after I was born. It's the first place I remember growing up. And it had something to do with drug trade, U.S. involvement with. People are going to look this up and write you and tell them. They're going to say, like, she's an idiot. She has no idea what she's talking about. But it had something.
You were an infant, so you're absolved.
I was an infant, but I should look it up. I know that it had to do with port security and some major undercover drug importing and exporting thing that was going on with the U.S. And Japan involved.
Wow. And so that's why you were in.
So we were there for 3.5 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
What did you absorb of the culture?
It's funny, you know how we were talking outside a minute ago and you said you realized later than maybe you ought that there was a reason why you were obsessed with 56 to 64?
Yes, 56 to 65.
Culture.
Pre-British invasion, although the Beatles, I think they came in 64. But.
True.
So and it's the Camelot years, too.
Right.
It's my favorite.
Not everything Japanese culture, but it... you would think I would have connected the dots earlier, but I didn't. My sister and I both were always obsessed with everything miniaturized. like stuff. I'm not the kind of person that would have a dollhouse on display in my house, but I wish I had a separate house where I could hide dollhouses on display. Like anything that you make tiny in some fashion, I have to touch it. I have to talk about it. very colorful miniature printed things, anything like that. And my sister is the exact same way. And we got to talking a couple years back and we were like, this is a Japanese thing. This is why. As a child, I mean, they miniaturize everything. The food. All restaurants have miniaturized versions of the food in plastic.
Right.
You get miniature little prizes at certain subway stops that you can collect.
What happens when you see a Hello Kitty store?
I just freak out. And I used to have all the Hello Kitty, Twin Star, My Melody. I loved anything. Yeah, and also that sort of that Japanese style of animation. Not anime as much. Mm-hmm. That seemed seedy, even as a kid.
Yeah.
Because... yeah, there's some very risque anime going on.
Definitely.
But yeah, that style of animation and just everything being brightly candy colored and these sweet kind of alien open faces, I'm still very, very drawn to that. And Asian food, Asian culture, all of it.
Yeah. God, that's interesting.
Is your sister older or younger than
older.
You?
Older.
Got it.
Yeah. She remembers more than I do of it, but we had a good time. We had a really good time.
So at what point when you were growing up, and then I was also interested because that you were doing painting and studied painting. And was that something you did that you thought of being a painter? Or?
My father and grandmother both drew and were oil painters. My grandmother taught oil painting till she was 83. Very, very skilled, extremely talented. And my dad painted, but was more of a draftsman. And so they did a lot of work together where he did the charcoal drawing and then she painted it. But, he was very good. He didn't go to an art conservatory. I'm imagining that he was just trained by his mom. And it was just sort of pervasive in the house. My sister's very good artist as well. To the point where that's, instead of leisurely reading, when dad comes home, he drew and sketched. That's kind of how he dealt with his feelings and his emotions. So we always, that's how you, I mean, you got sent to your room, like calm down was about drawing or like, I think, you know, when we would, my dad would shade our Holly Hobby sketchbooks, which is sort of creepy looking. I was like, I don't want her to have muscle tone.
Funny.
Yeah. And I understood that that was a release for him from work because he didn't talk. He was in the Tet Offensive as well. And he took his sketchbooks there and drew all escapist, very, Americana, cowboys and Indians, and still lifes of the Old West. So we grew up doing that, both of us, and then I got very interested in it, so I started doing art classes and art schools after regular public school and just continued.
Does any of that help you as an actor? Or is it just more
I think so. Do you have a solitary...
I love cooking, but I draw and...
Yeah, there's something about I don't need the approval of a group of people to do this.
I find it very meditative to
100%.
Sort of, to sketch and draw and work on colors and...
Yes.
You know, I can't draw men, though. I end up drawing women constantly.
I don't like to draw men either. I had to get out of the anatomy classes and stuff that we took, but...
I just can't. I find like everything I draw is like, oh, another woman in bed with flowers.
Yeah. If I draw a man, he'll be extremely androgynous or very, very thin because I was always obsessed with Egon Schiele's drawings. But anything like beefy and muscular, like it's just not.
I find it hard to draw. Plus, most of the art books are, if you're looking at Gauguin or Picasso, you know, they're all women anyway.
It's strange, because we're, you know.
Men are hard to draw. I haven't cracked
it. We enjoy the male nude, everybody in this room, I'm sure, but it's, but draw, no, I would prefer drawing women every time.
I just find it easier. There's curves and.
It's more fluid. You know. It's strange.
I was thinking about it. I wish there was a way to crack that, you know, because it's like, I've got to draw.
Practice.
There's got to be, just practice.
Literally, it's practice.
Drawing men.
Hands and feet are supposed to be the hardest things to draw of anything.
And, they are.
That was a hard one to crack until my teacher made me draw that all semester. And I'm still not great at it, but you get to a point where you're just like, like anything. If you practice a song long enough, you're going to sing it better.
Do you think it's important? Because I think as an actor, early in your career, when you have a lot of free time because you're not, you know, you're just trying to get a job and you're getting together with your friends, you're doing all these creative things. Then you get successful and then you sort of lose touch with the fun, creative things. So,
yeah, sometimes. And like, I have a studio, an art studio connected to my house now that I'm blissfully, gratefully, often too busy to use, but just having my art supplies on these shelves and knowing if I wake up tomorrow morning and I have an amazing sculpture idea, there's clay right there, and then there's or if it's an oil painting that's in my head, there's that right there. Mm-hmm. When I'm on set, when we're in New Mexico shooting, I love to teach myself new stuff constantly. Mm-hmm. I love YouTube videos too. I taught myself crochet and embroidery. I can't quite get the hang of knitting yet. I don't know why I can't crack it yet. But those things, when you talk about meditative, I learn my lines up to a certain point, and then the challenge is I have to do another activity while reciting the lines.
That's great.
To use like left, right, brain, or it's not even left, right, but to force myself to find out, like, how, because as you know, as an actor, you can think you know them and you get there and it could be as crazy as they've said, actually she's gonna be riding a bike in this scene, and now you're like, shit, and like suddenly you don't know anything. But it also can just be being having them in your body that much that if you can do them while you're doing a crossword puzzle, which I'll also do, then they feel more lived in by the time. It doesn't matter if, oh wow, Bob's going to deliver his line walking away from me instead of even looking at me. That is really something that I've got to take in. So I use it in a meditative way and also a technical way.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much in terms of the show, do you get the lines way in advance? Is it sometimes, are they being handed? How does the script process work?
I want to say the average, there's been a couple of things that had to come later, and a couple of times you got them earlier because it was something very difficult they wanted you to look at. But the average was 2 to 3 days before you start shooting it. Maybe 3 days would be about the average. But the shows, like most television shows, one-hour dramas anyway, I know you know, but for the sake of your audience, are shot continuous. You don't take a break. Multicam sitcoms typically do 3 weeks on, 1 week off. But even they, it's not like you stop Friday and a new one starts Monday. Episode 7 might end on a Wednesday, and episode 8 is starting on Thursday. So if you're in scenes Monday to Wednesday of number 7 and you just got 8, sometimes there's a little crash going on of trying to learn the new ones while you're memorizing the last ones, because there isn't a break between, is all I'm saying. We do have a great benefit of there are almost no rewrites, which is kind of bizarre on television. I'm used to having the rainbow script where, because every rewrite, every new draft that comes in is a new color.
Right.
And so then your script looks like a rainbow. And I'm really fortunate that AMC and Sony are, they kind of really leave the writers to do their thing. And Vince Gilligan, Peter Gould, and this incredible room of writers that we have. So I've done scripts that are white, which I've never seen before in my life, meaning like it did not change.
Yeah.
And that is really nice to know that when you do get a script, if you only have 3 days, but you've got a monologue in there or a really difficult scene, I can call Bob and we can start rehearsing it that day between takes, because it's not like, I'm not going to dig into this if they're taking it out tomorrow. Right. It's kind of set. You have a foundation you can really build on.
Right. So I want to go back just a little bit before that, and you're here and you're doing sitcoms and things like that, like you were on Whitney.
Yeah.
Did you like the experience of working?
I loved it.
In a live audience? I mean, that's great.
It's fun. It's fun.
It's a whole different animal. So you rehearse.
It is.
You get a script.
Yeah.
You do a table read.
Yep.
And then it's completely rewritten.
Which table reads have become crazy. I don't remember. I don't know what the last time you had to do a TV table read is. Never.
No,
because you're a star.
No. My experience of doing table reads is you read it, you go in, somebody gets fired, and then you get
What it is now. It's insane.
You get a new script. You're like, I liked him. He was nice. I so used to see
and
him.
Table reads in theater.
I'm afraid.
You would be told over and over, this is about the words. The playwright needs to hear their words. Please don't put too much spin on it. Everybody, we're just, you know what, we're here to just, like, let's literally start at ground level. Let's not be. And then TV, I remember my first show I got was a sitcom, and I was flown out right after I finished doing a Playwrights Horizons play, and we did a table read, and thank God someone did tell me, but they were like, this is more like you bring your A game. And actually an A plus, because if you're trying to sell a joke, and we ask, because the table reads, they invite network and studio and all these people. And not only is your job on the line, but dude who got to write his first script this year that wrote that joke, his job's on the line. Right. If you don't sell the joke well, it's very stressful. And I won't name which show, but there I did one table read where the network, the head of development on our way in for the very first read of this new show said, okay, everybody, make sure you bring your A game. We do fire people from table reads, so make sure you bring an A game today. And I'm like, I mean, sweat shot out of my armpits. I was like, and guess what? We sucked. We sucked so hard, everybody. Yeah. That we had to be called by the showrunner and say, this is unheard of, but they want a second table read or else, like, we're just going to not, we got to scrap, we're doing a second table read. And I was like, why? And they were like, because it was awful, and I really need you guys to think about it. And it was delivered in a way as though we messed up, and I was like, dude, I was on a firing squad. Yeah. Like, how do you perform into that? So it's weird. Table reads are very weird now.
How'd that second table read go for that show?
Better, but still, I mean, I think many people are of the belief that having your feet shot at while you're dancing will make you dance harder, but I'm not. I think we brought an A game that was intimidation and fear, but underneath of it, a love for the characters, and we didn't want the show canceled, and we didn't want the show taken away from us because they truly loved the characters. But I will always hold in my soft my soft heart always tells me, like, would have been an A plus without the fear.
I always do something like
that was an A minus.
I do do you ever do any tricks? Like, I do something really like bullshitty, like the star of the show who I don't know, who I've never met, I see, you know, if they're like over at craft service.
What do you do? Now I have to know.
Like, I kind of like go up to that. I walk before the table read. You got to make sure to go up.
Okay.
Hey, you know, I saw blah, blah, blah. Oh, man, that was so great. You're so awesome. And then they'll always go, thanks so much for doing this. Like, are you kidding? You're half the reason I'm here is because of you. You know, like, I'm such an admirer of you. And then you sit down at the table, and then that person is like, you know, they'll give you a little bit more at the table.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I like
but
that.
I don't think that... I mean, you prefaced that story by saying it was kind of shitty to do. But yeah, don't
Why?
You
Falsely
always...
Falsely buttering the person up?
No, but don't you always mean it?
No.
Ah!
No.
You often do, though, based on how you've told stories similar to that.
So, somewhat, but it just...
I am often mistaken for at least four times that I can name, mistaken for craft service while I'm over there by all these people.
That's so funny. They always think I'm wardrobe.
Awesome. Really?
I always get wardrobe. Are you here for wardrobe?
That's like, funny.
Because the little vintage dresses
For sure.
And the kicks.
I hang out by the craft service table, and I'm very nervous around the whole energy. Even once you start shooting, the energy of now we're doing, like you said, the jockeying for who's important here, who are you supposed to kiss up to, which clique do you belong in? It makes me a nervous wreck. And so I hang out by food, and inevitably there'll be a guest star that's more famous than I am that will be like, can you do anything about getting toasted bagels? And I'm just like, I think I can. And I go and I try to find toasted bagels.
Well, it depends on the exact... Like you said, to me, that technique is not for the star. It's for the executives to have a harder time firing me.
Sure.
Because it looks like that I'm actually friends with the person or something like that.
I don't think it's that shitty.
I mean, I don't either.
You know? I've had the opposite where there was somebody really famous, and I met her on a movie set with a friend of mine, and I didn't want to say anything to her because, you know, and she came up to me at craft service like, aren't you going to say hello? And I was like, oh, I didn't want to bother you. I didn't know, you know.
That's also weird. There's some sets where they, or especially an audition or a table read where you're not supposed to act like, there's been executives where I'm like, I've hung out with you. Oh, we're not doing that. Oh,
yeah.
Hello, Chris. And I'm like, why are we and I don't know why. And so I tend to act very strange and robotic around people because I don't know. I'm not sure what the cue is yet. It's a strange world.
What's so crazy about that, all of these, I wonder if there's any equivalent to this in just the normal workplace.
I mean, my sister's a teacher, and when she tells me stories, I'm like, sounds the same as a set.
Yeah.
You know, the teacher's lounge, and the people you have to get along with, and
politicalness. So when you were doing the sitcom, how'd you like the experience working with the audience? I mean, that's sort of the big component of
sitcom. I mean, and, you know, sitcoms, a smart sitcom is as good of acting as anything else on television, and it pisses me off when they get a bad rap, because when people are like, well, you know, multicams are just, they're always dumber, but you ask them their favorite shows of all time that they think are some of the smartest comedic acting they've ever seen. All in the Family, Cheers, Taxi, Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda, you know, Maude. I'm like, well, those are multicams. It depends on what you write and how you perform and the network that allows that. And now my friend does One Day at a Time, the reboot, and she's with Gloria Calderon-Kellett with Mike Royce and Norman Lear, obviously, but it's brilliant, and it's doing everything that a sitcom should do, and I loved that staging. At no time did I feel like, oh, well, this isn't as realistic. If I were to mumble my lines and face upstage, then this shit would get really dark. Like, that's not the point. I'm doing proscenium-style staging, you're externalizing choices instead of internalizing them at times, the same as you would in a farce. And that doesn't make it better or worse. It's that's the style, and that's the stage you're playing. The thing that was a little weird was the minuscule delay and the fact that the live audience actually watches the TV monitors. They don't watch you. So you look out and you have an audience staring at a TV screen, which is a lot like auditioning. So I'm like, I don't know whether I should play to them. And then timing-wise, you have to negotiate just this teeny tiny delay because, you know, you're taught if a joke isn't getting a laugh, like, move on. Don't hold for it. But sometimes it would then come and then you've started your next line. So you had to figure that out.
I used to do another thing. If we were shooting a sitcom and I was screwing up, I would just laugh or trip or something like that. To ruin the take. I mean, because knowing I did it bad, I was like, I do not.
I don't want them to use
tape because you'd only have like two chances. So,
yeah, it's fast. It's
so
fast.
I break, and inevitably, people actually like when you break. So it was another horrible, 100%. Horrible cheap trick.
And I grew up at the Carol Burnett Show, and I was like, I just wanted to be Harvey Korman. The best breaking the business.
That's right. I like all that stuff.
You know what I missed, and I still miss it, is that one of the things that makes theater the most alive and exciting to me is that moment when actually something goes wrong. From small to big. I don't care if it's a person having a sneezing attack in the front row or literally a set wall just fell. Or realizing, blinking to each other, the prop knife that is the only way the scene can end is not out here. What's our plan? And you're like doing it in Morse code. Those moments where there's this weird tacit agreement with the rest of your cast of like, do you want to keep sailing the ship?
Yeah.
Doing it. And you go. I love it so much. And I remember the first time the very first take on I'm With Her, which was my first television show. And something went wrong. A door didn't open or something. I was so sad that they yelled cut. I was so, because I just thought like, let's see what happens if the door is jammed. Yeah. You're like, what would your character do?
Yeah.
And it wasn't crazy method land as much as it was just like, I love that. I love the promise. And I love the promise with the audience, too, of like, I know you know that door wasn't supposed to be locked, but let's see if we can all stay in this world for a minute.
I love stuff like that.
Love it.
When I started doing movies, I started simultaneously also doing sitcoms.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That must have been kind of weird.
Well, I went. It was hysterical because I was known as this dramatic. You know, like, I was a clown. I did comedy, and then I did all these serious movies, and then... You know, so I had this opportunity to be on, I think the first sitcom I did was The Single Guy, and I worked on that. And I had a blast doing it, you know, but I wasn't, because I didn't want to get typecast as being, you know, just dramatic actor. So did you, when you were doing sitcoms, did you have any fear of like, oh, now I'm going to be typecast as sitcom
I didn't
girl?
Have the luxury to have the fear of it at the time. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I was so thrilled to get. I literally was flown out to screen test for that. And I'd always wanted to do on camera work as well. Again, not there was no qualifying of better or worse than theater work. I just wanted to additionally do on camera work. And I was pretty much told they had people they wanted and they had some names in place and this whole right. business, but you could be a part of a screen test and read for some LA casting directors that I'd never met. So yeah. it was, I really didn't think I had a chance in hell, which is why I think I had a decent audition. Later I realized, you know, on the third sitcom, and there was a great drama that was coming out that I wanted to read for, and the producer was a fan of my work and knew my work, and I was excited and thought like, oh, excellent. Does that mean I get to go straight to callbacks, or what does that mean? No, it means he's not interested in seeing you because he just thinks you're a comedic actress and he loves your work. And I was like, well, I'm not going to go in there with clown shoes on. Like, I get that it's a drama. They just don't, and it's weird because in theater, you're expected to be able to act. Now, there are, and this sounds snotty, and I don't mean it that way towards a dramatic actor, but I do think there are more comedic actors who also do drama than drama actors who also do comedy. There are definitely some dramatic actors that I think would openly say, I don't really do comedy. Timing is not my deal. That's not my jam. But in general, I think people, like, why are they afraid of versatility? It was very strange to me. I was very lucky that Sharon Bialy and Sherry Thomas, who cast Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, do not see actors that way. And so I was called in for Better Call Saul. They just didn't care that I had a history of comedy.
And did you... that's the key thing, is having casting people, you know, on your side. Did you ever have something, I was saying at the beginning, like my, you know, crazy, like Alan Parr, did you ever have like bad audition, like something that's just like hysterically bad?
Oh, yeah.
Where you come back?
Yeah. Yes. By the way, the show did not play out there, so I couldn't hear you guys. Were you talking about a bad audition? Did I miss that?
I will not retell it, but I was obsessed with the movie Fame.
Me too. Obsessed. Really thought that I should do Coco's monologue. Not a good idea. Nope. No, you shouldn't. That's not appropriate. Is that what you were doing?
We were talking about.
I was like, or Leroy. And they're like, not appropriate either. Yeah. What is wrong with you? Yeah,
she was Barry Miller.
Yeah, I was Barry, you know, Barry Miller. And I was a combo of all of them.
That's Do you know that I used to be in love with the monologue in the airport for Search and Destroy until I saw you do the film, and you were so brilliant that I was terrified to ever do it again.
Thank you. You know, I wrote that. I wrote that monologue.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's all me. They later put it in.
It's in the little playbook.
Howard Corder wrote it, but I rewrote it and I added all the Tippi Hedren and the
really?
It's so me. I mean, if you think about it.
Well, I didn't know you that.
You know, and then I'm going to write a movie. It's all
Yeah. Oh, I loved it.
My fingerprints all over that.
So you auditioned as Coco? Is that what you did?
But we were saying that I was like, I couldn't wait. You know, I had auditioned for Alan Parker, and it was a train wreck, and it was like horrifying. And he actually said to me, "Who sent you here?"
And then turned his back on her.
And then got up and walked away.
Really?
He got on the phone and called Frances McDormand on the phone. While I was there. He goes, "Howard, can you get Franny on the phone?" Like, I was in the room. And then I waited for him to dismiss me. And he turned around at one point and looked at me like, "Why are you still in the room?"
There's so many. I can't even count them. There's so many. I try
but
to
like
tell.
The people have. I mean, you don't have to say the names, but like people. Have
I had
her
to.
If you want to say the names.
Oh my God!
I would say the names because I think it's funny. It's nothing personal.
No, I remember I went in to play the love interest of a famous person, and I actually didn't think he would even be there to read because sometimes they just screen you first. But he was there, and I had done a tiny role in a film with him. Probably 10 years prior. I didn't expect him to remember. I mean, I had like four lines with him. I didn't expect to remember him to remember me at all. And it was, you know how you can tell in some auditions you can go in and it's very obvious there will be some chat time. In other ones, it's very obvious that you should sit down and start. This was a sit down and start.
Yeah.
But they did say, "Here's so-and-so," and I said, "Hi, nice to meet you." And I wasn't hoping to gain a lot of points by saying I've met you before. It just kind of came out. There was something about my subconscious that was like, I need to say what I'm thinking in my head, which is, "I don't know if you remember," whatever. So I said, like, we have actually met before. And the plan was to say, "I played like four lines in a film with you when I was still in college, 10 years ago," whatever. And instead, I don't know why. I have no idea why, except that I am a nervous wreck in auditions. And there's a room full of studio execs. All that came out was, he goes, "Really?" He was mortified that he didn't remember.
Yeah.
He goes, "Really? I'm so sorry, I don't remember it." And I was like, "Well, we slept together." And then I just stared at him and said nothing else. And he turned blood red and started apologizing profusely. Everyone got super uncomfortable. And I just let it sit there for like way too long. Yeah. And then I was like, just kidding. And then read the scene and they were like, leave. Yeah, there was no callback for that. And I also auditioned once that involved me having to write an entire, I had to write a network a letter to say I'm not on drugs. Based on their thoughts about my audition. And let me just tell you, I don't do drugs, and I was not high when I did this audition. I was given a note to take it further by someone that was outside of the room. And they said, no, they really, really, really want to know of the... It was the screen test, the final like network test. It was like six people there, and they're like, they secretly really are wondering who is, you know, who is risky enough to like take it. Like, she's, this woman is literally living on another planet. I was like, really? It seems like, that might, I mean, like, that might be too far. And he's like, no. They are wondering who's going to go for it. And I did. It involved a lot of lunges. I mean, I added, and that's the other thing, is changing your audition 30 seconds as you're being called in. I was like, okay, how do I up the stakes and the risk? Yeah. Literally, if I hadn't had an egg, I would have put it in my pocket. It was that kind of moment of like, how do you artificially raise your stakes fast? And so I was like, she's a woman who actually exercises the entire time. She's in conversations and that mini monologue in the middle, it's a song she's making up. She thinks she's doing Carrie. I mean, it was insane choices, but they were all choices.
Yeah.
I did not hit anybody.
Did you have you run into any of these people?
They'll never call. I have, and they avoid my gaze.
Oh no!
Yeah, I'll never work there again.
That it's is okay. terrible.
I wasn't on drugs. If anyone's listening and that was in that room, I wasn't. On drugs.
Wow.
I was so bummed too because I was like, nailed it. I feel like I nailed it. What I said. All the way driving home. I was like, dude, my risks were amazing.
That's what I said at the top. I said, what's so great about actresses? We're delusional. You're like, killing it.
Totally.
Alan Parker, killing it. I had a tear. Like, I was like, I said, I was on set. I was already out and like, oh my God, I'll be able to buy this and that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who sent you here? That's always my. Do you are you thin skinned about? I never read. We talk about this all the time. I never read reviews.
So hard now.
I'm anti. I don't.
I used to avoid the newspaper. I mean, now it's hard.
I don't want to hear a critique unless it's from like a famous director about my craft.
Right.
I don't want to hear like.
What about your interviews? Do you read those?
No, because they're usually it's like they're. You know, the quirky actress, saucer-eyed actress.
Or being misquoted or paraphrased in a way that you're like, that's not at all.
Yeah, they paraphrase me or they don't. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly what I said. Even if I see something accidentally, mm-hmm. I get upset. I just saw something, an interview with Allison Anders, and I love Allison, but the interviewer focused the entire interview, and the headline is her being the protege of Martin Scorsese and the making Grace of My Heart. So, like, again, they're not even factually accurate.
Weird.
Yeah, so doing the interviews these days, I try to avoid them.
I'm pretty thin-skinned. I am.
Yeah.
And I said one time in this other interview, people were like, well, you know, what do you say about the fact that you've got to build up thicker skin, to be an actor. And I was like, I don't know. I feel like I am paid to keep my skin just like cellophane. Everything's just barely under the surface. It's hard though. I enjoy social media, and so that makes it really hard to avoid some of these things.
Right.
The whole idea of mixing and becoming friends with critics and reviewers is interesting and strange to me. There are some writers that I absolutely adore. But it's like, well, what if they slammed my next project? Wouldn't that be weird when I saw them? I was even telling this journalist the other day, I said, this is still, even though I've been doing TV now like 12 years and I did theater for 10 before that, the idea of hanging out with the New York Times reviewer that was watching your play is not a thing. That's not going on.
Yeah.
You will not be going to their cocktail party.
Yeah. That was the old days.
Yeah.
It was a week with a star. And then write a story about them.
Sure, but the reviewer, they're not going to go to the party. They race out of the theater.
Roger Ebert Roger Ebert used to hang with.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was friends with all the big directors. And it was a different, so he'd, that was sort of the rap sometimes on reviewers. But, they'd give someone a pass. for the movie. You know, now it's like thumbs up, thumbs down. It's
right.
it's either, you know, black or white. Has interactions with the fans, with the show, changed your performance at all? Like, is there, what are you trying to do? Because the television show is like an amoeba. It sort of grows.
Yes, particularly ours. It's not the same characters, different circumstances.
Do you go back and watch early ones and go, what was I doing there?
I do that with the entire body of my work. I'm just like, really? That's the choice you made?
I just look at my hair. I'm like, whoa, why did I think my hair was good that way? That's all I care about. Yeah,
what's funny about watching early work of mine, it's the same as the auditions we're talking about. What's most excruciating is not like, wow, that is some shitty work that's forever on film or tape now. What's sad is I always thought I was doing good at the time. It wasn't like I was like, this is shit. I was like, I'm killing it.
Yeah.
Which sounds like I'm fooling myself. I'm not. The second I leave the set, I drive home and I'm constantly like, they're going to fire me. Oh, yeah, they're going to fire me. Yeah. I mostly operate as though I'm one scene away from being found out as a sham at all times. I'm like, I think today is the day. Whip, pulled the wool over their eyes for 22 years.
Have you ever been fired? I was fired once, twice.
Definitely, I guess I should say yes, because it isn't. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. It was shows getting reconfigured and they're changing the cast. I was never the only person that was let go and then the show's going, but it felt like a firing for sure. I've had god awful things said to me by writers, producers, casting people. Everyone loves you for the role, but we have to get a girl that's hot. Like, I've gotten that one multiple times.
What? What does that mean?
I don't know.
That's the dreaded thing that everybody sort of talks about, or fears.
Can she come back in, but more feminine? I've had that for callbacks.
Oh. Wear a bikini or something.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I was in a dress, when I had done the audition, and I was like, naked or higher pitched voice? What do you think he thinks feminine is?
You know, it's interesting. I had the opposite. I used to always get cast as the funny friend, and then on the set, they would pull me aside and go, you're a lot prettier than what we first thought. You thought I was ugly. Now, like, you're discovering, that I'm pretty. And so they would try to make me ugly. They were like, it was the opposite thing. Like, they want, which I thought was so terrible. I was like, why should the funny friend be unattractive?
Right. There has to be, it has to be like some massive non-compete clause with your friend or something. Yeah. It's very weird.
It's like the Lucy and Ethel. Like, Ethel had to weigh 20 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
More. It's as if, like, you can't have, you can't be.
Well, look at Fred. I mean, Fred versus Desi.
Fred was, he was like preggily deceased. He was so old and grumpy and nobody liked him. So we can't talk too much longer, but I want to to talk a little bit about your experience of working on Broadway.
Well, I was an understudy that got to go on. That counts, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I did my debut was with, that was Neil Simon's 45 Seconds from Broadway that he wrote about. It's a love letter to the Edison Diner where he used to hang out with all those people. And so it was a diner set with multiple and all Tony Award winning actors, like some of the best of the best. So I got to, and Jerry Zaks directed it, and he demands that his understudies come to every single rehearsal the entire time, whether it's your scene that you're understudying or not. Likewise, you have to be in the basement for all performances. You can't even, at that time it was a pager, you can't even have your pager on and be at a restaurant. You have to be in the basement. So there's a whole sub microcosm cast downstairs that's like trying to play chess but listening. And he would tell us, he was like, I've had an actor break their hip in the middle of a scene. I expect you to complete their line. Like, get up there that fast and on stage. I was like, okay. And Kevin Carroll, and who's wonderful on The Leftovers, and Julie Lund, she was playing the role that it came down to she and I for the role, and she got it, and they asked me if I wanted to understudy, and she was lovely from the get-go. She was so wonderful, and she was so great in the role, but those were the two kind of wide-eyed young people that Neil Simon has in a lot of his plays. But the rest of the stage was Louis Zorich, Louis Statlin, Alex Corey, Bill Moore, the great Marion Seldes that I was just obsessed with.
What a great face she had.
Oh, God, and her voice and her grand gestures. Yes. is. Yes.
It's like a big bird, like a big crane. Or
just
something.
She's phenomenal. David Margulies. Who else?
And did you
Lewis Statlin?
Did you interact with Neil Simon?
Some. He was there with his wife. I can't think of her name right off. You know her, actress.
I don't. The last one I remember was Marsha Mason.
Oh, okay. No, yeah. After that. Yeah, he was there all during previews. And
did you talk to him? I mean, my God, like I would have.
No,
been.
They were understudies. There was an elitist. You definitely felt the level of like understudies stay back thing
okay.
going on there. Right. And like the AD directed us, not Jerry. But I sat out there during rehearsals so I could absorb everything I could.
I see. We need to hang out.
We weren't
I would
treated
have
like
immediately
poop,
stalked
but we were.
Him.
Yeah, I need you on my team
I would
a lot
totally
more.
Stalked him.
But then we previewed during 9/11. So or no, right. Sorry, we previewed right before 9/11, and so yeah, it was a tough opening. By the time we opened, we went back into previews. I think maybe 4 days after 9/11, and I remember getting the call telling us to show up for a run through, and thinking, "Are they insane?" I was living in Brooklyn, and I was like, "Are you insane? They're still telling everyone to not get on the subway, don't gather in large public spaces like Times Square." And this was on this was the Richard Rogers Theater on 43rd, and it's. A play, like, who the hell cares? This is crazy. And then hanging up the phone and seconds later thinking, like, thank God someone is telling me, put your pants on, put your shoes on, go outside and go get on the subway. And it was crazy and it was eerie, but we did it. And, Anya, I had my debut there and it was so great.
Wow.
It was so great.
That's, that to me, to be on Broadway. And coming up for Better Call Saul... And as I said, we love. What's the biggest thing you've learned from doing the show?
How to be still. I mean, there's a thousand things, but specifically my character. This is I'm usually the awkward, dorky. I've played some like B. Arthur, kind of the tuba in the symphony, kind of the low lower register wit. And so those people can tend to be even in Roxanne and Whitney had that, but they're always kind of like. Strange and physically awkward at times, and this woman is it's very, very still. Always, she doesn't like to give anything away in gestures, even facially, and so that's been challenging for me, but really, really fun. That, and I mean, my writers and my actors are just—they're phenomenal. I've never seen that kind of dedication to. I've worked with such great people, and there's nothing against them, but. It goes back to studio and network too, giving us the time. There's a supreme honoring of the storytelling there. That's like we're not going to mess with this. We don't care how long it takes. We don't care if it's a 12-page dialogue scene, and we're just going to hold on a 2-shot. It's all about the storytelling and nothing else.
And do you recall like the best direction that anybody ever gave you?
There's been lots. I'd like to hear yours. I've had lots of great direction on this show.
Well, the biggest thing that I always say is the director who creates an atmosphere on the set where you can really feel like you're not making a fool of yourself. That's,
agreed.
For me,
it's key.
It's creating.
Thinking that you could try something out that might fail is everything. Yeah. Otherwise, you will be a B+ forever.
Yeah. You gotta feel as if you can cry or laugh or...
Yeah.
Like you said, no one's going to call cut. You can just reach a peak of some sort.
Yeah. There's episode 10, our finale episode this season, when I first come out of the room after the accident and I'm quiet, just sort of eating and make a couple of jokes. And you can tell that she can't stand needing help and is sort of contemplating all of that. There's a point at which, unprompted, she says, I drove on almost no sleep and crossed 3 lanes of traffic and I could have killed someone. And we weren't sure what this is definitely a fissure in Kim's armor. I don't think she is comfortable at all being that vulnerable or even thinking about that her actions could have killed someone. And so we basically did this. I was like, you know, for shorthand, let's call it big. Let's call it small, medium, large here. Like what this fissure is, what is this dam breaking? And, I've never felt as safe as I did this time to do. There are takes that are like snot flying crying of that scene. And then there was like a middle. And then in the end, we decided like she's so contained that even the slightest like wavering was the way to go, and that's the one that made it on there. But I've had a lot of great direction. You don't need to worry about playing likable ever is my favorite direction I've had on the show.
Yeah,
and that was from Peter. He was like, if she's mad, she's mad. If she's tired, she's tired. You don't ever have to make sure you give one more smile when you leave the room to the dude.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's, I love great direction when you get it. You sort of know it. Well, anyway, thank you so much for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me.
Please come back anytime.
I would love it.
Thank you,
goofy
Ray.
Thank you.
It was amazing. You can find Ray on Twitter and Instagram at Ray Sehorn, R-H-E-A-S-E-E-H-O-R-N.
Yes, in the Twitter world.
Thank you. And you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, now out in paperback. Oh,
I was
going to
clap. And then this
was good.
These are my typical auditions.
Check out our Facebook page, and the website is ileanaspodcast.com.
Yes. And as I always say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's the end of our show, but not the end of our life. But thank you so much for
being here. Thanks for having me. This
Please
was so
come
much
back.
Fun.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Have a great day, everyone.
See you next
Bye.
Time, everybody.
Yay!
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.